Hello and welcome to Science World. Today we'll hear about the discovery of a new meat-eating animal. You've probably heard stories about people having near-death visions of light and tunnels. Turns out that those visions just might be the way our brain responds to dying. And did you know that we hear not only by sound entering our ears, but also from vibrations detected by our skulls? A California scientist tells us about his research into how we hear and how much of what we hear is in our heads. This and much more coming up for you on VOA Science Health and Technology magazine, Science World. Scientists say they have discovered a new species of mammal in the cloud forests of South America. Suzanne Presto was at the Smithsonian Institution this week when the researchers announced their discovery.
There's a new mammal in the world today. The Olingito is a furry orange-brown creature with a sweet face, big eyes, and small, fuzzy, rounded ears. It lives in the trees of the cloud forest in South America, weighs 1 kilogram, and measures about 75 centimeters, including the furry ring tail that makes up half of its body length. It shares its family roots with raccoons and kinkajous, and although it is a carnivore, it mostly eats fruit. And while it has long existed in Colombia and Ecuador, the Olingito did not exist in the science books before now. Christopher Helgen is the curator of mammals at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington.
Think about these cloud forests. This animal, like so many animals in the rainforest, only comes out at night, doesn't come out of the trees, it's wet, it's dark, it's socked in with cloud. It's hard to find these animals.
Helgen led the research team that discovered the existence of the Olingito. As it turns out, people have known about the Olingito, but misidentified it for more than 100 years as the similar but larger Olingo. Helgen was studying Olingo specimens in a museum 10 years ago when he noticed a difference in the size and shape of the heads and teeth. This led him on a quest to determine if he was looking at a previously undescribed animal.
This happens in science a lot. We sort of assume we know a lot. We assume what we think we know is correct. Until our team comes along and says, no, it's not just one Olingo in the forest. There's an Olingo and an Olingito.
A decade of detective work took Helgen from storage areas in museums to cloud forests in South America. He contacted a zoologist in Ecuador who one night managed to capture a few seconds of grainy video that scientists say shows an Olingito in the trees. That video confirmed the Olingito's existence. Helgen says even people who live near the Olingito's natural habitat do not differentiate it from similar animals.
People are usually most familiar in their world with those animals that are most relevant to their daily lives. And I think that's a big part of this story is the Olingito. It's small, it's not very hunted very much, and it's just up in the trees. And because no one's had much of a chance to take a closer look, no one's really understood what this animal is.
Helgen says it is likely that tens of thousands of Olingitos live in the wild and are not about to become extinct. Humans, however, are encroaching on the Olingito's habitat in the Andean cloud forests. The research team estimates that 42% of historic Olingito habitat has been removed. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Researchers are getting ready to track the annual migration of zebras next month in Africa. This year, they'll be helped by some space-age technology. Joe DiCapua reports.
Sometime in September, zebras begin their trek from Botswana's Okavango Delta to the Makatikati salt pans. Peter Beck, a research associate at the Woods Hole Research Center, was among those studying the migration.
Like most large herbivores that naturally migrate, zebra migrations have been under threat across the globe. Most of the big migrations already are under threat. So conserving the ones that exist is, of course, important, and finding ways where people and wildlife can live together is critical if you want to achieve that.
So researchers turned to the U.S. space agency NASA and took a close look at some of its satellite images and data.
The NASA instruments that we worked with orbit the Earth, and they give us a global picture of rainfall and of vegetation productivity. So that's the two metrics we extracted. The rainfall data you can get for the tropics in particular, and we can see every 6 hours from satellites an estimate of how much it rained. For the vegetation data, we can see globally every day if there are no clouds, how productive the vegetation is. Is it green or is it wilted or is it dry?
What Beck and his colleagues found was that when enough rain has fallen, there's a surge in the greening of grasses.
We do see that rainfall is what gets them going. That was very clear. But then once they're on the move, they appear to rely both on rainfall and the productivity of vegetation, because the leg of the migration we looked at is at the end of the dry season. So when we look at the vegetation that's surrounding them and how green it is, really, we can tease out how fast the animals will migrate.
And they'll follow the greening vegetation. But Beck says the zebras are in tune with the environment and don't simply move blindly in one direction.
If the rains then abate or you get an interruption, then they'll actually reverse their migration, which is something that had only very rarely been documented. They'll reverse their migration and wait for the next spell of rains. Same thing when they return from the very productive grasslands where they are in the wet season. If you get a very late rain spell, they'll actually reverse again and extend the period that they can graze in the grasslands.
Researchers wanted to know whether being in tune with their environment would help the zebras and possibly other migrating animals adapt to climate change.
In our research, we assessed the chance of those weather systems becoming decoupled and really the cues that animals rely on now not becoming reliable anymore in the future and whether the animal's behavior is adaptable enough to cope with that.
That kind of knowledge could help in the conservation of wild animals. He also says knowing which migration routes animals will take may help game park rangers and others better protect them from poachers. Beck and his colleagues presented their findings in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Biogeosciences. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Imagine being able to travel from San Francisco to Los Angeles in about 30 minutes, in half the time that it now takes to fly the nearly 650-kilometer distance. Science World's Bob Doty tells us how these time-saving trips might be possible.
This past Monday, entrepreneur Elon Musk, the visionary behind the online payment service PayPal, electric Tesla cars, and SpaceX, the private space program that successfully sent a payload to the International Space Station, unveiled his vision of future transportation called the Hyperloop. The system would work similar to the pneumatic tubes that transport capsules stuffed with paperwork in older buildings. Inside a large tube, capsules would float on air, traveling at more than 1,100 kilometers per hour. The air would be sucked by a powerful fan at the front and expelled at the rear. Musk said he was prompted to develop the Hyperloop design by what he says are inefficiencies in the planned high-speed rail system in California. He said the Hyperloop could cost less than one-tenth of the $70 billion estimated for the rail plan and would be six times faster. Musk says he has no plans to develop the project himself. Instead, he plans to publish the design as open source so that it can be modified or used by anyone. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. Coming up, a California scientist will tell us what he is learning about the way we hear. So today we want to know the medical term for our outer ear. From the following, is it A, the Malleus, B, Pinna or Auricle, or C, the Incus? Think about it and see if you can come up with the right answer. We'll reveal the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
People surviving cardiac arrest often describe a so-called near-death experience where they see a bright light or a tunnel. Now, scientists are saying that that near-death experience may actually be the brain's response to death. Jessica Berman has a report.
The near-death experience is universal, with an estimated 20% of people across cultures who've suffered cardiac arrest, then recovered, describing a variety of similar otherworldly images. Because there's been no scientific explanation for the images that appear so real to the people experiencing them, the phenomenon has been written off as a religious or even supernatural hallucination. Most scientists believe this occurs at the time of clinical death, when the heart stops pumping oxygenated blood to the brain. Jimo Burjigin of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor says she became interested in the near-death experience because of one image recalled by every cardiac arrest patient.
One thing is that they all seem to see bright light. And to me, as a neuroscientist, I would think, aha, there must be visual cortex activated.
So Burjigin and colleagues designed an experiment involving 9 normal adult rats. The investigators measured the electrical firing of neurons in 6 different brain regions using electroencephalograms. The activity was recorded in areas that are involved in emotional responses and sensory information, and structures where learning and memory take place. Electrical brain data were collected while the rats were in a normal waking state and after they received anesthesia. The animals were then given a lethal injection of potassium chloride that stopped their hearts from beating, says Burjigin. As scientists continued to measure the rodents' electrical brain activity throughout and for 30 seconds after they died.
Information processing in the brain is actually much higher level during this 30-second period. In those brains of the rats and compared to their waking state, which is really what caught our excitement, if you will.
The researchers believed heightened communication among different structures in the rats' brains at the time of death, due to a lack of oxygen, caused a surge of neural activity and connectivity, possibly explaining the vivid near-death visions reported by humans. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
For years, we've been hearing about a unique personal transportation device called the jetpack. It's something that we would strap to our back, and after pushing a couple of buttons, would take off and go flying through the air. It sure would make commuting for many of us a whole lot easier. Now, a company in New Zealand is one step closer to making the jetpack a travel reality. Science World's Siri Nyrop tells us more.
The Martin Aircraft Company, based in Christchurch, says it has been given approval by New Zealand's Civil Aviation Authority to conduct test flights for its prototype jetpack. The company says the personal aircraft can climb to higher than a kilometer and travel at speeds of 112 kilometers per hour. The company has already conducted remote-controlled unmanned flight tests of the pack. They hope to have the aircraft commercially available sometime next year. Martin Aircraft intends to initially market the jetpacks for emergency and defense use, while continuing to develop a lighter recreational version. They say they've had more than 10,000 inquiries about purchasing the jetpack, which they intend to sell for about $150,000. For Science World, I'm Siri Nyrop.
According to a new report, sea levels were at record highs and Arctic sea ice was at historic lows in 2012. Roseanne Skirbel tells us that researchers studying these trends have taken to the skies in a new flying laboratory.
This Gulfstream V corporate jet has been modified for science. In place of the luxury seats for business executives are banks of computers and dozens of weather instruments.
Many of them mounted in locations around the fuselage, some of them inside some of the atmospheric chemistry measurements. Bring gas through the tubes that you see at the top of the airplane inside to let them make their measurements as they fly through the air. Others are doing the measurement remotely through windows in the airplane.
Al Cooper is the chief scientist with the National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, who helped guide the aircraft from drawing board to takeoff. The flying lab is called HIPER, which stands for High Performance Instrumented Airborne Platform for Environmental Research. HIPER climbs high to 16,000 meters and travels far more than 11,000 kilometers without refueling. Cooper says scientists helped craft the design and lobbied to get it funded.
The community was really asking for these kind of capabilities for several reasons. One was the altitude capabilities. They wanted to reach the upper parts of the atmosphere. And the other was long-range capabilities, to be able to conduct studies that are global in scope so that we can monitor questions like what is the carbon dioxide distribution around the world.
HIPER collects data by flying over clouds and storms to the edges of the stratosphere, beyond the reach of most research aircraft. It can travel to remote regions over oceans and track atmospheric chemicals as they move around the globe. Cooper says the instruments take measurements as events unfold.
The main thing this gives us is the ability to measure in place. There are some remote sensors that the plane carries as well to be able to extend those measurements above and below the plane as it flies along. So the instruments that it carries measure along the flight track, and they measure with high resolution, much higher than you can get in any other way.
Among the instruments taking measurements in real time are drop zones, packed in epoxy-hardened cotton tubes and jettisoned from the aircraft. NCAR engineer Nick Pott says they record pressure, temperature, humidity, and wind speed.
With the aircraft, we actually can fly to where we're interested in going. So oftentimes, these things are used in hurricanes. So we fly to the hurricane, fly around the hurricane, and then, you know, pick spaces where we want to launch them. What the real observational purpose is for is to actually help with prediction models for hurricanes and where they land.
Pott says better predictions can ultimately save lives. Among HIPER's recent projects was a mission to study plumes of dust and pollutants blown from Asia, and flights to analyze severe weather across Colorado's Front Range in the adjacent Great Plains. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Today, we wanted to know the medical term for our outer ear. From the following, is it A, the malleus, B, pinna or auricle, or C, the incus? All three choices are parts of the ear, but the answer we were looking for is B, the pinna, which is also called the auricle. The pinna's job is to collect sound and direct it towards the ear canal, where it is then processed by a number of internal components, including the eardrum, malleus, incus, and the brain, to provide us with a sense of hearing. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
When we hear sound, you may think that sound waves are simply picked up by our ears, where it is processed by a series of internal components that send signals to our brain. That's true, and that form of hearing is called air conduction. But did you know that our sense of hearing also comes from a second source as well? Our skull bones also provide another way for us to hear through a process called bone conduction. Dr. Sunil Puria from Stanford University studies how we hear and recently has been investigating bone conduction hearing. He says that by getting a better understanding of how we hear just might someday lead to new technologies and innovations such as those that will help the hearing impaired. Dr. Puria joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about bone conduction and what he has learned so far about how we hear. Some of your recent research involves bone conduction. Now, What is bone conduction and what role does it play in hearing?
So bone conduction is this alternate pathway to hearing, which is if you vibrate the skull in any way, whether it's through a mechanical vibrator, or if you tap your head, or when you speak, for example, your vocal cords are vibrating. Those vibrations are transmitted through the soft tissue and bony tissues of our skull and our neck and head, and that then stimulates the cochlea as well. In fact, the early days, in the early 1900s, it was thought that there were two sensory mechanisms for bone conduction and air conduction, and people subsequently showed it's actually the same mechanism. That is, in both methods, bone conduction or air conduction, it's the cochlea that gets vibrated, and then you hear. So bone conduction is this other way of hearing. So as we speak, you hear through both the air conduction pathway and this bone conduction pathway.
Now I know why my voice sounds different when I'm listening to a recording versus to what I'm listening to while I'm speaking. So that's part of bone conduction?
Yes. Normally, you get both pathways. Your vocal cords are vibrating, and it provides an input to the cochlea. And as your lips are moving, it goes from your lips to the ear canal, and then you hear through the air conduction pathway. So normally you get both, and they're kind of about equal. But when you have a recording, even though you can reproduce the sound perfectly well at the ear, you're only reproducing the air conduction pathway. You can't reproduce the bone conduction pathway because that would be direct mechanical stimulation. And that's why it sounds weird to us. And, you know, our own voice, when we first hear it recorded, sounds so weird and different because you can't get both through a recording.
What I would like to know next, Dr. Puria, is in the research you've been doing concerning hearing and bone conduction, have you learned anything in your research that surprised you?
One of the things is that it seems that this bone conduction pathway is directionally dependent. Because the cochlea is spiral-shaped, which direction you shake it matters in terms of how much hearing you might get. So that's certainly one thing that's important. The other is that most people didn't know there's two mechanisms of bone conduction. One is, think of the cochlea as like a water-filled balloon, if you will. If you take this water-filled balloon, you could translate it, that is to shake it horizontally or vertically, and the fluid inside the balloon would move. So similarly in cochlea, if you inertially move it, the fluid inside would move and let you hear it. The other is you can take this balloon and compress it, and when you compress it, because of asymmetries in the cochlea and different windows that are there with different impedances, you will hear as a result of the compression as well. So there are these two mechanisms for bone conduction hearing, and we've been trying to understand which is more important depending on maybe the frequency or the direction. So we've been, you know, looking at that, and that's kind of an area of our future research. The other thing we found that's very interesting that's related to the three middle ear bones that I mentioned earlier, that the middle ear bones actually affect your ability to hear by bone conduction. And so maybe the shape of these middle ear bones and the reason why only mammals have these three bones is that perhaps these bones have evolved to produce less bone conduction, reduce our own voice through bone conduction hearing. And so, you know, we're looking at these different aspects of research.
The research you're doing right now hopefully will help us better understand how the hearing process works and perhaps look into ways of addressing hearing loss. So with that in mind, why do we lose our hearing? What are some of the common causes?
Well, loss of hearing, there are multiple mechanisms, obviously. One is certainly through loud exposures to sounds, especially sudden impulsive sounds, are really problematic in terms of hearing. A single loud impulsive sound can do more damage to a person's hearing than a whole year's worth of listening to loud, steady music or being in a loud airplane or something. A single impulsive sound will produce much more damage than any of those events. Of course, genetics plays a factor. Diet also can affect hearing loss as we age. You know, so there are multiple reasons for hearing loss. It pays in the long run to preserve our hearing as much as we can.
The research you're doing, will that help people restore hearing or restore at least a wider range of hearing?
The work that I do at Stanford is all related to basic science of hearing. So definitely, hopefully, as we learn more and more knowledge, we can try to find ways to mitigate hearing loss or at least diagnose better ways of hearing loss. So, for example, the bone conduction work you mentioned earlier, we're trying to find ways to better diagnose hearing through bone conduction and hopefully find ways to do things. I'm also working at a startup company called EarLens Corporation, where we're actually making a very novel type of hearing device, which is based on photonics. The idea there is for people who have age-related hearing loss to allow them to hear, but hear high frequencies particularly. So the broad spectrum of hearing is not restored with common acoustic hearing aids. They only go up to about 4 or 5 kilohertz. And the idea with this new device, which is photonics-based, it will go up to 10 kilohertz, which will allow them to hear better in noise, sound localization, and all those good things that come from high frequencies.
That was Dr. Sunil Puria, a mechanical engineer and a consulting associate professor at Stanford University in Stanford, California. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. We'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.